If then you have been raised with Christ, seek things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming. In these you too once walked, when you were living in them. But now you must put them all away: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self with its practices, and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge after the image of its creator.
Good morning, everyone. It is wonderful to be with you all this morning. The song service this morning has been incredibly moving. C.S. Lewis defined humility as blessed self-forgetfulness, and I feel that this morning. I hope you do as well. Our God is really, really wonderful and worthy to be praised, and so I am just happy to be with you this morning, as with every Sunday, praising our God with you. We're continuing a study from last week where I'm sort of presenting to you what our college group is going to be studying here this fall. And our theme for this fall is a greater story, a greater story. And so we're sort of unraveling our Christian story again this week, and we're finishing up sort of the last part of our series. And last week we talked about what's in our past, where we come from. What sort of story is in our past that defines our present? And what we decided, what we sort of determined last week, is that Christians are in a uniquely difficult spot. Because if there's any story that defines our past, any story that unites us as a people, it's the story of Christ dying for us, Christ's sacrifice for us in our past. We determined that someone has died for us, and that we are the products of great sacrifice. We are people who have a sacrifice in our past. And that's really difficult, because it's difficult to come to grips with that. And how do we live with that? The fact that somebody has died for us, how do we grapple with that? And so we talked a little bit about that last week, and we decided that there are two ways that we can go about doing this, two ways to go forward, mainly. The first way is that we can look at our past, we can look at the sacrifice that Jesus has made for us, and we can deal with this sort of tension that we have, and the fact that we know that we're unworthy, and we can try to go about earning this sacrifice, earning our salvation, earning Jesus' death, which, as you know, is impossible, one, and also it misses the point. Or second, we can remember Jesus' sacrifice, join in his death and resurrection and baptism, and live our lives in service of his kingdom. As we've already sung this morning, why should I gain from his reward? I cannot give an answer, but this I know with all my heart: his wounds have paid my ransom. We can remember what Jesus has done for us in our past, accept it, and then, as Jesus commented to Peter just last week as we read, we can move forward in service of his kingdom by feeding his sheep. Now, we have this enormous sacrifice in our past. This is where we've come from. And the question that we are wrestling with this morning, and the question we're going to try to answer this morning, is what lies ahead? What is the hope that unites us? What's promised? With what hope do we live our lives today? And how should this drastically change the way that we live? And so today what we're going to do is look at what is our future hope. We're going to ask, what is our future hope? What is our present hope? And how do we live in response to this hope? So first of all, what is our future hope? We're in Colossians chapter 3 this morning. Thank you to Elijah who read that for us. And we're going to sort of be bouncing around in Colossians chapter 3 and in a few other different places, but the passage that we have chosen to sort of center our theme around this year in our college group is Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. If then you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above and not on things that are on earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And here's our hope. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. This is our future hope, that when Christ, who is our life, appears, we will also appear with him in glory. This week, Justin gave me a book to read. He loaned me a book, and it's N.T. Wright's Surprised by Hope. And N.T. Wright is a writer that I have thoroughly enjoyed in the past. And he writes this book mainly to point out that Christians often have a sort of skewed idea of the afterlife, of our hope in God. And what he hones in on specifically is what Paul focuses on in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, namely bodily resurrections. He says, you see, Christians have this idea that when we think of our future hope, what we think about is, you know, we live our life and then eventually we pass away, but as soon as we pass away, we go to heaven, and that's sort of the end of it. But what Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, what he focuses on and what N.T. Wright focuses on in his book is that it's much more than that, that we have a hope that's much greater than that, namely what he sort of hones in on is bodily resurrection. What Paul focuses on, and we'll turn to 1 Corinthians 15, beginning in verse 51. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. What Paul tells us here is that, yes, when we die, we inherit some sort of rest with our Creator, but much more than that in the end time, bodily resurrection, a life after this one, not merely a redefinition of death, but a triumph over death, that our life doesn't end, it continues after this one. And not only are we promised a new life in Christ, but in Revelation chapter 21, one of my favorite passages from the Bible, verses 1 through 4, we're promised a new heaven and a new earth as well. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more, and I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from heaven, out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. This is a great hope. And we can talk all day long, and I've enjoyed this week reading this book and sort of talking or sort of thinking about the sort of theological implications of a bodily resurrection, of a life after this one. We could tease this out all week. We could do this, but the biggest implication I think that we can find from this actually comes from 1 Corinthians again, chapter 15, but down in verse 54. We'll just name this one implication of our future hope. In 1 Corinthians 15, beginning in verse 54, he says, when the perishable puts on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Finally, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. In the Lord your labor is not in vain. In other words, Paul says, God gives us victory over death. In the end, we live, and because he lives and because we live, our life on earth can matter. The labor of our life is not in vain. That's an enormous implication. I used to, before I worked here, I used to work at FedEx, And I was a package handler for a while, and eventually I started working in the office. And for a while, my job was to find lost packages. People would send me emails from different stations across the country, and they'd say, "Hey, Josh, this package was supposed to get here at this time, but it stopped at your station, and it hasn't been scanned in like 2 or 3 days. And then what I would do is I would take that, and I'd go in the warehouse, and I'd find the package, and I'd throw it on a belt, or I'd lightly set it on a belt, and send it on its way. And one week, I went on vacation, and nobody did my job the entire week that I was gone. They just didn't, you know, packages weren't getting found that week. And if it was your package, you know, I'm sorry. But they just didn't pick up my job. And so I come back from vacation, and I find this out, and I open up my email. I just have a long list of people asking about their packages, and I say, "Oh boy, you know, this is going to be a really horrible start to my week." And what I discovered was that most of them, if you just gave them enough time, they kind of found their way back into. They kind of found their way home on their own. That if you just wait a couple days, eventually somebody, you know, found it and threw it on the belt, and it was fine. Which was great because, you know, I didn't have a horrible Monday. But then, you know, it sort of sets in that, like, I don't know how much my job actually matters here, you know, because all week I was gone and basically everything was fine. And I didn't tell anybody this because, you know, I enjoyed being paid and everything. But, you know, it felt weird. I felt very inconsequential. And I think it felt weird because I think people need to feel consequential. Our lives need to have consequence. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who feel this way about their lives just generally, right? Because when your story begins with random harsh chance, right? And then you're here now, and then it ends billions of years from now when the sun eats the earth, utterly rendering all of your, you know, decisions and ultimately your life inconsequential, that's a bleak place to be, right? And this is, unfortunately, a lot of people feel this, right? They feel inconsequential about their life. If eventually my life ends, what's the point, right? King Solomon in Ecclesiastes, he sort of echoes this existential complaint in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning in verse 2. He says, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down again and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, and around it goes the wind on its circuits, and the wind returns. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea is never full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will always be. And what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it is said, 'See, this is new'? It's already been done in ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after." Again, in chapter 9, beginning verse 2, "It is the same for all." He's talking about death. "It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner, and he who swears as he who shuns an oath." It's the same comes to everybody. And King Solomon isn't the only one to sort of name this complaint. Marcus Aurelius, one of the great emperors of Rome, emperor about 100 years or so after Jesus' death, he writes in the last 10 years of his life, he starts writing a journal, sort of a journal called the Meditations, is what we call it. And at one point, Marcus Aurelius, arguably the most powerful man in the world, you know, he's reaching the end of his life, the last 10 years, and he writes to himself, not, not thinking anybody would ever read this, he said, you know, Alexander the Great and the person who drove his mule both died, and the same thing happened to both. They were absorbed alike into the life force of the world, or dissolved alike into atoms. And in another place he says, some things are rushing into existence, others out of it. Some of what now exists has already gone. Change and flux constantly remake the world, just as the progression of time remakes eternity. We find ourselves in a river. Which of the things around us should we value when none of them offer a firm foothold? In a third place, Ernest Becker, who we read from a little bit last week, he's an anthropologist, but he's sort of an existentialist psychologist, and so he chalks all of our sort of mental problems, emotional problems that we have, down to the problem of death. And he says, to be human, full humanness, means full fear and trembling at least some of the waking day. Which is pretty optimistic, right? He said, this is the terror of human life, to have emerged from nothing, to have a name, conscious of self, deep inner feelings, an excruciating inner yearning for life and self-expression, and with all of this yet to die. It seems like a hoax, which is why one type of cultural man rebels openly against the idea of God, for what kind of deity would create such complex and fancy worm food? One way to put it, Ernest Becker. And finally, the deepest need, he says, the irony of man's condition is that the deepest need he has is to be free of the anxiety of death and annihilation, but it is life itself which awakens it, and so we must shrink from being fully alive. What is he saying? He says, when we have this fear of death, we know that ultimately things end. How can we truly live? Right? And it doesn't seem right. It seems like a hoax. And what is the Christian response to this? What we find here in Colossians and all through the Bible is that the Christian response is not so. Not so for two reasons. One, because this was never the intention. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity, at what point he says, what is the problem? A universe that contains much that is obviously bad and apparently meaningless, but containing creatures like ourselves who know that it is bad and meaningless. And there are only a few views that face all of these facts. And one is the Christian view, that this is a good world that has gone wrong, but still retains the memory of what it ought to have been. This was not the intention. Why is death, why is an ultimate end? Why does that feel so unnatural? Because it is unnatural. Because we are eternal beings dropped in a finite world that was never meant to be finite. And we just weren't built for it. It's like if you take, big, chunky, enormous tires, and you put them on your car, right, and it doesn't drive right. It's because the car wasn't built for that, right? And that's the extent of the car metaphors for me. So that's what you're getting, tires. Second, why is this not the case? Why is this? Why do we have a greater hope? Because there's an answer. Because there is an answer. In Colossians chapter 3, back to where we started. We're bouncing around quite a lot. But Colossians chapter 3, notice the progression. There's sort of a, I think in biblical studies, what they call a chiasm, which is just a structure of this phrase here, but I'll walk you through it. In chapter 3, beginning in verse 3, and notice the progression here. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. Notice the progression. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. The progression is from death to life. Right? But notice the caveat here in the middle. When Christ, who is your life, appears, your life is hidden with Christ in God. And the question is Christ your life? It's the difficult question that we have to ask when we look at this verse, these verses. Is Christ your life? Is Christ my life? Are you so captivated by him that it's producing noticeable change in your life? Really think about that. Noticeable change is as Moses goes up to the mountain and he sees the face of God, it changes him and he comes back down and his face is shining and people see it. Is that our relationship to God? Are you so close to him that you feel his death lived out in your life every day, or are things pretty much the same? Is your life so attached to his that when he appears in the end, you will appear also with him in glory? This is our future hope, that there is life that doesn't end. That there is, and not just a redefinition of death, but a triumph over it, real life after this one. That is our future hope. What is our present hope? Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. If then you've been raised with Christ, notice the past tense here. This is really odd. If then you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Further down into verse 9, do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self, past tense, with its practices, and have, past tense, put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge after the image of its creator. Notice the present and the past tense there, right? We have a future hope, right, of life after this one. We have a future hope of a new world. But that doesn't mean that our life currently, that we should treat our life currently as the boring, inconsequential waiting room to heaven, right? That's not what we're supposed to do. There's an immediacy in Paul's voice in chapter 10. You've put off the new self and you're being renewed now. Right now, there's an immediacy here. And this immediacy, the way that Paul talks here, it's caused some scholars to even wonder whether Paul wrote this because it's so immediate. But if you look in other places in Paul's writings, I think it's a constant theme. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he sort of does this thing again. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 16. From now on, therefore, we regard no one according to the flesh. Even though we once regarded Christ according to the flesh, we regard him thus no longer. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. He's not going to be a new creation. He is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us a ministry, the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. Therefore, we are ambassadors of Christ. God making his appeal through us, we implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. Notice here, we are new creations, and we have been given a ministry of reconciliation. We have a future hope of new life, but we can begin that new life now. We can begin the process of conforming our image to Christ now. We can be a new creation now. We are promised a new and redeemed heaven and earth in the future. But there's an immediacy here. We can start working towards that now by helping to bring God's presence and God's kingdom here in the world today. And remember that our labor is not in vain. Our mission isn't to sit in the lifeboat and to urge others to get on before it's too late. Our mission is to work with God in the world to reconcile ourselves and others to him. And this is exactly what Jesus means in Matthew chapter 6 when he prays, Our Father in heaven, holy be thy name, your kingdom come, your will be done. Where? On earth right now, as it is in heaven. Christians are people who look at the picture of the kingdom given to us in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 through 7, a picture of a kingdom in which those who are mourn are comforted, a kingdom in which those who are hungry and thirsty for righteousness are filled, a kingdom where people don't murder, but they also aren't angry with each other, a kingdom where people don't commit adultery, but they also don't lust, a kingdom where people are the salt and the light of the earth, they preserve what is good in the world, a kingdom where people love their enemies. Christians are people who look at a kingdom like that and say, I'm going to help build that here now. Christians are people who pray, God, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Your kingdom come, your will be done right now. This is our work, to conform our image to Christ and to reconcile the world to God, to help in that work. This is our work and our present hope. This is our present work, but our present hope is that it can be done. And I think it can. Last week we talked a little bit about the Lord's Supper. We spent a fair amount of time talking about the Lord's Supper, and I'd like to do that again today. What interests me about the Lord's Supper, one of the things, is that Jesus could have picked any feast, any Jewish celebration in order to explain his death to his disciples. And really think about that. He could have chosen the Feast of Booths. He could have chosen the Day of Atonement. You think that would have been a good one? But he chooses the Passover as the last meal to share with his disciples. And he sort of hijacks this feast and turns it into something new. And why the Passover? Why does he do this? And I think it's because the Passover is a story of immediate salvation. You remember in Exodus chapter 12 is where the Passover gets instituted. You remember in the beginning of Exodus, the people of Israel are oppressed by the Egyptians, and God sends plagues, and God sends Moses to tell the Pharaoh to let his people go, but he doesn't, and so he sends all these plagues. And finally, they're getting ready to leave. God's going to send the final plague, and they're going to go. But before they do, the night before, they eat a meal. God tells them to eat a meal together. And what happens in chapter 12 is that God is very specific about one thing in particular, and that's the unleavened bread. When you remember this in the future, you'll eat unleavened bread for something like 14 days before, and you won't keep any leaven in your house, and you'll make sure that you have unleavened bread, and you'll only eat unleavened bread, and then you'll have this Passover meal. He's very specific about the unleavened bread. And why is that? I think it's because he wants us to remember that this was a quick meal, that this was immediate salvation. Why was the Passover meal eaten with unleavened bread? Because the Israelites were saved so quickly that their bread couldn't rise. They couldn't give their bread time to rise because God was saving them right now. If you remember in Exodus chapter 12, verses 11 and 12, he tells them to eat this meal with your sandals strapped on your feet and your staff in your hand, because you're going to eat this meal and God's going to save you right now. God saves right now. And the reason we eat unleavened bread today when we eat the Lord's Supper is to remember that aspect of what Christ was telling his disciples. He was reflecting back on the Passover. And to remember this aspect of God's salvation, that yes, we have a future hope, but that God saves today, right now. And how many of us really believe that? Think that sin in your life, the one area of your life that you keep falling short, that you keep struggling with, the sin in your life that's been oppressing you for months or years or however long, that's been ruling over you, as the Egyptians rule over the Israelites. Yes, we have a hope that God forgives us for these sins, but how many of us really believe that God saves you from that sin today? That God empowers all of us to defeat our enemy today and walk as new creations today? And what about our world? We look at our world and we see a pretty miserable place. Last night, Madeline and I went and we watched Sound of Freedom. Yes, sorry. Sound of Freedom, which is a movie that highlights sort of the horrors of child trafficking. And when the movie ends, just the whole theater is just silent. Nobody's getting up. It was a silence of people recognizing the real horror of the world, the real evil that's in the world. The seeds of evil that are in the world that have grown rampant, and more than that, possibly the seeds of evil in our hearts. We look at the world and we see it as a horrible place full of evil and disorder, and we hope for a future renewed world, a renewed heaven and a new earth. But how many of us believe that Jesus gives us the power and calls us to start changing that world right now and today, and that we have the power to start pushing it in that direction? We have the power to work with God to bring his kingdom here. And the biggest question of all, what if we did? I mean, what if we really believed that about God's salvation, that it's not a future thing primarily, but it's present, and that it's immediate? This is our future hope. This is our present hope. Now finally, how do we live in response to this hope? I've exhausted my time here this morning. I'm going to read, just as we sort of close here, I'm just going to read you a couple quotes from Surprised by Hope by N.T. Wright that I thought were really helpful in thinking about this. How do we live in response to our hope? N.T. Wright says, "Our task in the present is to live as resurrection people in between Easter," uses resurrection, "and the final day, our resurrection with him. With our Christian life, corporate and individual, in both worship and mission, as a sign of the first and a foretaste of the second. And second, because the early Christians believed that resurrection had begun with Jesus and would be completed in the great and final resurrection on the last day, they believed that God had called them to work with him in the power of the Spirit to implement the achievement of Jesus and thereby to anticipate the final resurrection in personal and political life, in mission and in holiness. It was not merely that God had inaugurated the end. If Jesus, the Messiah, was the end in person, if he was God's future arrived in the present, then those who belonged to Jesus and followed him were empowered by his Spirit and were charged, as we are charged, with transforming the present as far as we are able in light of the future. How do we do that? By living according to the sacrifice and to our hope. Remembering where we've come from and where we're going and the hope that we have in the present. And as we sang just a little bit ago, his grace reaches me and will last through eternity. Now I'm under his control and I'm happy in my soul. This is the culmination. This is our story. Immense, great sacrifice to heal us and reconcile us to God. Hope of a life that continues after this one with our Savior. Hope of a new and renewed world, a new heaven and a new earth where God dwells with his people. And the hope and the work in the present of bringing God's kingdom here, of reconciling ourselves to Christ, and the hope that that can actually happen. This is our story. It's a wonderful story. It's the only story. Why won't you make it your story this morning? And let's just all think about this while we come and stand and sing.